Now, without further ado, let me introduce our last speaker, David J. Pate, Jr. David's a senior consultant for the Center on Fathers, Families, and Public Policy. He's a former director of the Male Adolescent Center in Chicago, Illinois. He's a former director of the Paternal Involvement Demonstration Project in Chicago. And he's a former program manager of the Ounce of Prevention Fund, Division of Parents Too Soon. He's received a bachelor's degree from the University of Detroit, a master's degree from the University of Chicago, and he's currently pursuing a doctoral degree here at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's had several awards. I'm only going to mention a couple. He was a 1990 Kellogg National Leadership Fellow, and he was the USJC's Outstanding Young Man of America. He has such a wealth of experience on this topic. We're really happy that he could join us today and talk about bringing males into the picture, which is an issue that you've indicated you're very interested in on past evaluations of the seminars. So welcome, David.
Good morning. I've only had 3 hours sleep. I'm studying for a statistics exam, so if I fall asleep up here, just excuse me. Many of the talks that we had before I came up were very eloquent and very well done, so I feel like I had this speech, so now I have this speech. So I have to really kind of just more or less summarize. But in a way of looking at sex education, I'll start out with what happened with me this morning with my son. My son is 2 years old, and we're a firm believer in our household that sex ed starts from the moment they come out of their mother's womb, and we hold them in our arms and say we love them. So this morning I said to my son, well, what's that on your body? He said, Daddy, that's my peanut. I said, very good. And so I feel like he's already getting the concept, and I think that's where it all starts, that we have to realize that we have the power to control how our kid's destiny is going to be, and that even involves sex education. I've always been a firm believer, even with my first child, who I had a daughter, in that she needs to know that her body is as important to her as it is to everyone else, and that she shouldn't let anyone violate that body. She should know that each one of her body parts are very important, and that she should hear from her father as well from her mother. So it's very important to me in our household that we understand that all of us are very important people sexually as well as mentally. The other thing that I heard this morning that I kind of kept writing down was that it's almost as if we're giving up our own control over our kids or what's going on with them, and that we're saying that we have no control over the situation that our kids are going to be facing, and that young boys are going to just coerce these girls into having sex, and these young girls just have no control over saying no. But a lot of this starts at home. A lot of this starts in our values that we set in society. A lot of this is about our own mindset as to how we pursue sex education and how we pursue to raise our children. The one thing I want to have us do for a quick minute is imagine when you were 13. Imagine what you were thinking about when you were 13. What were your goals? What was your ideals? What was your desires? Where did you want to be at? Because I remember when I was 13, I wanted to go to college. That was one thing my mother had always said to me, that you would go to college. So I knew that in order for me to go to college, there's no way I could have somebody pregnant. There's no way that I could engage in early sexual activity if I was not going to use some kind of protection. There was no way I could destroy my mother's opinion of who I was, because it would really break her opinion of me in terms of her friends at church. My relatives, my father would probably kill me and throw me out the house. There was all those things I knew I could not do to my parents, and that's what I think was my best sex education from an early point of life. And I think that we need to all think about where we are in terms of our own attitudes about our families and our kids. Some of the things that I thought were very important is that, one, societal views and expectations on males and females are very different, and it's a big issue to deal with. Dr. Vincent did a very eloquent job of describing the things that I had wanted to talk about. So it's no need for me to go back over that, but that's something to keep in mind. Also, some of the things we didn't talk about this morning was the risk factors involved with people who are involved in early sexual activity. The whole issue of drug and alcohol use, and where is that coming to play at when people are engaged in sexual activity. The idea of accessibility. In Illinois, where I worked at for the last 13 years, the issue of contraception accessibility was a major issue. I worked at the school-based clinic in Chicago, which was, I don't know if you remember, but it was called The Pill Goes to School. We were in national news for quite some time when we initiated the school-based clinic in Chicago. And the whole idea of accessibility was a major issue for us. The people in our community were not opposed to having a clinic there, but it was people outside of our community that was very opposed to having a clinic there. And how do you deal with that when you want to provide better access? In the state of Illinois, kids can get birth control at the age of 12 without parents' consent. And if a young woman gets pregnant, she can decide to have an abortion in order to keep her child without her parents' consent. And that's something to think about as well. What are the current laws that are in place that either facilitate or don't facilitate the use of someone making a decision about their bodies? And is that a wrong thing to do? again, why is it an issue that we have to see teenage pregnancy as a problem? I think that's something we need to really get at. What's the crux of the issue here? Not saying I don't think it is a problem, but I think we need to think about that a little bit more. And also, what are some of the most popular solutions for this? Is it just sex ed, or is it a combination of activities? And I think what I'm hearing from this morning's discussion is that it's a combination of activities. But again, looking at, well, who we work with, and I'm going to look at mostly people I worked with in Chicago who were males from the ages of 10 to... I worked with males from 10 to 35 years of age, so I can give you a wide range of what you do for those types of groups. But with the young men who were 10 to 13, I had to do something very different for those who were 20 to 25, because they're at different points in their life, they're at different developmental levels in their life. And one thing I thought was very important for me to do for those who were 10 to 13 was to, one, to get down some of the concepts, but first of all, to look at who their parents were and how can you get their parents educated on what the terminology was. Many of the parents of my kids I worked with did not even know what a penis was, they didn't know what a vagina was, they didn't know what a scrotum was, or testes, or sperm, or eggs, or ovaries, or any of that. So it was some basic plumbing stuff that we would call in the sex ed field. We had to make sure they knew and they understood how to appropriately talk to their kids and understand what were some of the consequences of that. Some of the things I would get from some of the young men at that age level who were just starting to experiment with sexuality, for instance, I used to get a very popular myth that if I'm going to engage in sex and I want to make sure this girl is what they would call clean, you squeeze some lemon juice on her vagina and if she screams, then she's not clean. And it's stuff like that I would hear every day in all the schools that I would work with that made me really realize that not only were our kids miseducated, but their parents were very miseducated too, because they were not giving them some of the appropriate information themselves. So some education with the parents is very important. But then you say, well, how do you get the parents involved? Parents have a lot of things to do. They can't come to some other than another session, another activity that would engage them in some kind of education. Many of the things that we would do, and we were lucky enough to have enough staff to do this, is that we would do round tables or coffee tables where we would have one person or a parent would sponsor a meeting. We would pay for the food, and you would have like 10 or 15 parents come to this one person's house, and we would be the sex educator for the parents. And we would talk about what are some of the issues that the parents are facing with the young men and their family. What are some of the things they need to do to be sure that their kid is at least a sexually educated person, but also to look at how can we help them to be more involved with their kid's life. Many times, particularly young mothers, give up their sons at a very early age. They feel, well, he's just a boy, he'll be okay, and that's the way he's supposed to be. But oftentimes we do it's very unfortunate we have that attitude, because unfortunately that's going to come back to you if you don't engage some early activity with your kids. And many of these young men are looking for some discipline, they're looking for some control, and unfortunately we give it up. We say, well, they don't need it because they're a boy. We don't need to do a lot of things with them because they're a boy. And we thought it would be important for us to also look at what role do coaches and teachers play in this whole role of encouraging some sexual activity or other things that we thought were not good behaviors on part of males. One thing that we did with many of the high schools in Chicago was that we also trained coaches and some of the teachers and those principals on how do you work with your school to be a more appropriately based place for sex ed if you would like to do that. It didn't work as well as I would like it to, unfortunately, because many people thought it was not an important thing. It was not to be a part of their job, even though many of the young men that would come to them were presenting with being a father or presenting with them with STDs. But we still thought it was something to try in those schools that were willing to do that. One of the problems, too, with the sex ed program or with teaching about STDs is that many of the young men, when I was in a hospital-based program, did not believe that they thought it was okay for their penis or their a certain part of their body that hurt all the time. And I was to have men present to the clinic, young men present to the clinic, who has had gonorrhea 6-7 times in a row because they thought it was a normal part of their life to have that. They thought it was a normal part of their life for them to have a discharge that was not like a urine discharge, but a discharge that was kind of whitish and mucusy and did not feel very good. I don't mean to mess up your breakfast this morning, but I'm trying to be realistic. And also in our school, and the one way we saw that it worked much better in our school-based clinic program was that many men came to our school-based clinics in a way that was much better than we anticipated, because of the fact that they saw that as an accessible place, the staff was much closer to their age, and we made a concerted effort to hire people who were just out of school or much younger. We made a concerted effort to hire young men in the program so they could see a role model of some type that would help them with the planning of their own sexuality or with the whole idea of being a sexual person and treating their STDs if they had that. In some of the other programs that we were involved with a school-based program for young kids that was an elementary school program, we had to be very careful about the rules and regulations of that particular school. And there were restrictions in the Chicago public school system as to how you educated about sex ed. One is that we could not talk about sex ed without abstinence. And we were very much in favor of that. And we did talk about masturbation in the sex ed program that we did all the time. It was just one of the modules that we talked about. And it was met with some problems, but we went in there saying that we needed to talk about people as a whole person, but not as just one type of sexual experience. And we thought that the kids had to make the choice about what they were going to do. Now people say you're being a little controversial about that. this area of work is controversial, and you can't get around it. But I do think to think that only sex ed is going to change the life of these kids is not enough. Many of the kids I work with come from situations which is full of hopelessness, despair, and not a sense of ever getting out of that situation. And I think the one thing that we do that's really not very good is that we think the sex ed program is going to make this kid's life better. And it's beyond sex ed. It's beyond just providing plumbing. It's beyond so many things that we just have not even started to really discuss in our country. And I think that once we get to a point that we recognize that many of these kids are in situations they will never get out of, I think that's when we may start making some changes, some policy changes that make a big difference. Money does help. It does help a lot to be able to provide some services and hire staff that are competent, but that's not the only answer. It requires people who really do believe that kids are worthwhile, that kids can make a difference, that kids have a mind. And also, but I think the main thing we need to think about is how do we get parents to be involved at an early age with their kids, starting from infancy and talking about sex ed and talking about birth control and talking about all the things that we want our kids to know. But the final thing that I think always helps me when I do my work and working with kids and is that I had to go back to think about when I was a teenager, when I was a young person, where was I in my life, and what made a difference for me to be able to look at these kids in a way that I think they should make a difference in their own lives as well. I kind of hate this time thing. I always feel like I'm rushing and I just can't say anything. But anyway, I look forward to your questions. I have a lot of experience that I'll be willing to share, and hopefully that'll be what I can contribute. Thank you.
Good job. Questions for David.
Did you use any teen peers for boys in our programs? And one thing that we did was we provided training for kids in our later part of our programs where we always did team teaching. And when I did do sexuality education myself, I usually never did it by myself. I always had a female counterpart who went with me because we thought it was important for the students to see that males and females are going to talk about this issue. And then we trained young men and young women to do it as well with us. So when I would do it, I may have a young female student or vice versa. It helped a lot. It was one of the things that did work. It wasn't the only thing that worked, but it was one of the strategies we did use to help that helped us a lot. Particularly in our high school-based clinic programs, we used a lot of teen counselors, and that worked a lot, worked well. Have we had any male mentors that work with Rites of Passage programs or other programs to bring males into the services that we provided? That's your question? When in our DuSable school-based clinic program, we had a Rites of Passage program for adolescent males. And we had someone coming from the outside to do that. I was an expert in that, and the male educator who was there wasn't an expert, but we had somebody come in who did provide that service. We always found that a good way to get men involved in our programs was to have an outsider come in and provide those services other than us, because sometimes when we're there all the time, they feel somewhat embarrassed if we see them coming into the clinic all the time. So sometimes when it's someone outside of the person who they're used to seeing, it does help to get more people to use the services. So we did utilize outside male mentors to be involved in our program. As a matter of fact, we had the 100 Black Men male program in Chicago, and we would have those men being actively involved throughout all of our school system programs. So, yes, we utilized whoever was available we would use. But one of the things that I found very interesting was that oftentimes in our hospital-based program, the young men were more apt to come to seek out female counseling. They would not want to see the male. They want to see somebody other than, because they felt that this how would this man know anything about me? Also, the young men preferred to have a female examine them as opposed to a male examine them, because I think it was some kind of homophobic problem with that. So we had female doctors as well as male doctors in our clinic who would do with, because a lot of these young men have never had a thorough exam, and it required them to really get, if they don't have a thorough exam, we know how that uncomfortable that can be. Even for me, it's uncomfortable to even say sometimes. So they would have a female physician do it, and it worked out better for some reason. And that could be because of societal values and homophobia issues and other things that go into that.
Okay, any other questions now? We've got, yes. The question is, how can we bring more men into our programs and as educators, right? And also people of color?
Men of color.
Men of color. What strategies can we use to make our programs more attractive? Yes, David.
One thing that we did in Chicago when I first started the program at the hospital was that the staff was all white, and I was the first Black male they'd ever hired, first male they'd ever hired. And the program had been predominantly providing only services to females. It was a train. I had to particularly sensitized the staff to the fact that not all males are going to beat them up, not all black males are going to rob their purses, not all black males are violent, not all black males are going to cause you some major problem. So it was on my part to be, one, I had to be sensitive to where they were coming from, because I could have been very angry and said, I'm not going to stay here because the stereotypes are too bad. But I decided that because it was a good issue to deal with, that I would stay there. And I think what made a difference was that the staff was willing to make a difference. And that's the biggest issue with any program. If the staff is willing to go the next step and go beyond their own racist or sexist attitudes that we all are born into, it makes a difference. And the one thing we did, too, we even changed the way our office looked. There was a lot of things that perpetuated or kind of facilitated more female-oriented themes, mother holding the baby, lots of Red Book and Home, House and Garden, and those types of magazines. And I'm not saying you need only Sports Illustrated, but you could have Time and Newsweek and other type of teen magazines that made more of a difference or were more generalized. Also, the biggest stopgap for us was our receptionist. And we had to get rid of our receptionist because she did not believe that males were worth anything. So we had to get rid of her immediately because she was a problem. And that's the first person the teens talk to when they come in to the office or who they talk to over the phone. And once we got rid of her, it made a big difference, at least in encouraging more males to be involved in our program services. In terms of men of color, in Madison, and it's kind of hard. I mean, it's not very many people of color in a city like Madison. But one thing you can do is, if you're willing to take community-based people who are willing to go through some significant amount of training, which requires a lot of time on your part, it can make a difference. But it requires a lot of time on your part to do that. And that's what we found worked for us. We didn't utilize as many community-based people because we didn't have to, because we had a well-rounded staff that was able to facilitate a lot of the work that we needed to have done. But in the other programs that we've had, we had to do a lot of training, and that requires a lot of after-hours work, weekend work, and the willingness to go that next level, that next step.
Okay. Dr. Vincent?
Let me give you a couple examples. And looking at context, though, the basketball coach in one of the schools is very successful, and he seldom loses, matter of fact. And anyway, he had taken two graduate courses. Three credit hours. He had been involved in two semester courses with me. Now, he was committed. He was aware. So then through working with him, he allowed one day a week with our site director there to go work with him with the boys. So he took time out from his basketball practice. But he only did that, I think, in my opinion, because he had been aware and enlightened through the graduate courses, and so he was very receptive. The other example I think of, in one of the black churches, we found this minister was very receptive, so we had lunch with him. And then it was a project of an adult male class. So in other words, these things happen because of the skill of the community leader who orchestrates and makes these things happen. I don't think if you advertise out there, you're just not going to get people to come in. It's really, really hard, though. I don't know. It's really hard to maintain groups. And I look at this crowd here, and 80% women. If I did a thing on sexuality, how to be a better parent, there'd be, if 20, there'd be 16 women and 4 men there. And so it's really, really hard to get men involved, black, white, whatever.
Okay, other questions? Yes. For the urban inner city, it is sometimes a badge of manhood to have a child. If we suggest not having children, what else can we offer as a substitute? Is that? When they don't see a vision of hope for their life in any other realm. Okay. David.
One thing that we have done in the programs that in Chicago, again, is that, one, I don't use the word underclass because I think it's too negative. I mean, what's it, are we overclass? I try not to use that term, and even being a social worker, we have a lot of jargon that I try not to avoid because it's too deficit focused. But those youth who are in the urban cities, it's such a complex question, and Dr. Vincent did such an excellent job of saying things that I would have said, because it's more, the baby does not really seem to be a badge for many of these young. I fail to believe that. I mean, from the men I've talked to who are now 32 and had a baby when they were teenagers, they never saw it as a bet. They saw it as something that they knew they could accomplish, but it wasn't like something they wore in their chest and said, "Look, I'm so proud to have a baby out of wedlock." Because all these young men that I've worked with, they want to have a house and they want to have a wife and they want to have a job. They want to be respected and well received. However, for whatever life has dealt them their current lifestyle, they know that's not an option. So the sense of hopelessness and despair is much more than I can even describe to you unless you've experienced it. And seeing some of the men I've worked with, I can't give you an answer, but that's the bottom. I just can't give you an answer. And I know that the men that I've worked with do not see this badge of this baby. They love this baby, and they want to take care of this baby. But societal mores, which require them to be seen as head of household or the breadwinner, contradicts a lot of that. And a lot of these men know they can never be the breadwinner because they can't read, they can't write, they can't sustain a job. And it's more than it's hard to even explain unless you've seen it and experienced it. I'm not saying that the programs can't make a difference that we have currently out there, but I think it requires a lot of people really deciding that these people are worth their time. The men I worked with who were 30 to 35, I would get them jobs. I would get them to have them. They would be paying their child support. They would get paternity established. They would be visiting their kids. But oftentimes it's the mother sometimes who says, "I don't want them around anymore." Even after you do family counseling and other work that we try to do, is still this whole relationship issue that no one really talks about in terms of what's the barriers here. A lot of times the barriers could be the mother because she's been told that this guy is not worth her time, and then he has not been around. She has a right to be mad. So it's such a complex issue. I'm not even going to try to give you more than just an experiential thing that I've seen. And the one is such a case-by-case basis. There's no grandiose one strategy is going to work with every single man because it's different for every single man you come across, or every young male you come across. For a young male, you might see more of the badge thing, but even with them, these young kids do not want to have a baby. They will tell you, "I did not expect this to happen." And because sex for them is so haphazard, or they never really planned to have sex, or they didn't think it was going to happen today, or I didn't have any birth control, but I wasn't going to stop the activity because I wanted to go forward with it. It happens. And oftentimes these kids have had sex, and they'll tell me, "Well, David, I had sex 3 times and nothing happened. So why do I think something's going to happen this 4th time? So it's such a complex answer. I can't give you no more than that.